Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Studies show that in some parts of the country, an increasing number of boys as young as 13 are having sex. And at that age, it's most likely risky sex. We're talking today about the role that sex education can play in this scenario. Dan Rice is director of training at the New Jersey-based organization Answers, which trains teachers and youth educators across the country about how to teach about sex. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Dan Rice.
Thank you, Ann.
13 seems young. Is that normal?
So it's not normal in the sense that we know from most statistics that most young people graduate high school not having sex. What we have to remember about some of the research that's come out recently is that it's self-reported. Mm-hmm. And in some areas, it might be an expectation that boys are having sex at a young age. So they're feeling pressure to report that they are when, in fact, they may not actually be.
What about girls? This one's about this. We heard about the boys in this score, but is there a sense about whether it's typical or, you know, these kinds of patterns play out for girls as well?
So we don't have any research particularly on that I'm aware of, at least specifically that girls are having sex at an earlier age either. We know that, you know, as an average, about 47% of young people report having sex by the time that they've graduated high school. In certain areas, we are seeing higher numbers. In certain areas, there's lower numbers. But again, this is all self-reported.
Mm-hmm. Does that differ much from decades past or years past? Is this a big change from, of course, assuming that it's all self-reported ultimately?
Right. So I don't know that we have a lot of research historically. We have a lot of research based on teen pregnancy rates and rates, ages of first marriage and things like that. We know that right now we are at a historically low rate for teen births, although as a country we are still one of the highest industrialized nations for teen birth rates and STD rates as well. We also know that these programs that are promoting abstinence only until marriage have not really adapted in the sense that we know that, according to the U.S. Census, the average age of first marriage is approaching age 30. Mm-hmm. So for young people to be, you know, given the message over and over again that they should wait to have sex until they're married for the first time, we have to really consider whether it's realistic that people are going to wait until they're in their late 20s and possibly even early 30s before they're going to have sex.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, our organization really promotes a comprehensive approach. And here in New Jersey, we've actually had a K-12 mandate for comprehensive sex ed since 1981. So this is something that we've been thinking about for a long time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about sex ed today. My guest right now, Dan Rice, he's director of training at the New Jersey-based organization Answers. If you have a question or comment, what do you think about sex ed? Thumbs up, thumbs down. It's up to the parent. Give us a call. We'll get to it later on. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why is it presumed that sex at a young age is intrinsically riskier?
I think because a lot of young people have not gotten the kind of sex ed to tell them and give them the information that they need in order to be able to protect themselves. We also know that there have been connections to young people not using contraception at a young age because they're not going into stores or they're not seeing healthcare providers to get a hormonal form of birth control. So there's risks in that area as far as STD transmission, as far as pregnancy is concerned. And so I think that's the largest connection that we could make around the risks inherent to having sex at an earlier age.
What about the we're at a historic low rate for teen births, but the opposite for STDs, or that they're high, but teen births are lower. What do we make of that?
So I think that that's what we're hearing over and over again is that young people are very, very aware of pregnancy and they want to do whatever they can to avoid pregnancy. And so many of them may be using, young girls may be using hormonal forms of birth control, but then they're not using condoms and they don't realize the risk that's associated with not using condoms in terms of transmission of sexual diseases. So they're doing everything that they can, and they may think that they're fully protected if they are using a hormonal form of birth control. And while the rates of hormonal forms of birth control are, you know, they should be very effective, they're not effective in preventing STD rates.
Around the country, so you said in New Jersey, it's been mandated K-12, sex ed has been mandated K-12 since 1981. What preceded that? What inspired that? Really, it's an outlier at this point, right?
Absolutely. The founder of our organization, or one of the early pioneers of our organization here in New Jersey, was on the New Jersey Board of Education, and she asked a very simple question. She said, how old do young people have to be in order to understand how their bodies work? And essentially, they started a whole commission to sort of answer that question. And that's what got the mandate started here in New Jersey. And, to say we have a mandate is true, and we've had that since 1981. Like a lot of states, there's not necessarily enforcement behind that mandate. It really depends on the school to sort of take the mandate and run with it and make sure they're implementing it properly. But it's important to note that across the United States, there are only 24 states in the District of Columbia that mandate sex education.
How have standards – I think New Jersey is probably a good way to look at this since it's had K-12 sex ed in place since 1981. How have standards for sex education changed over time?
So there are no federal standards for sex education. There are some programs through the CDC that provide guidance, but there are no federal laws around sex education. That's basically handled on a state level. As I said, there's 24 states in the District of Columbia that mandate sex education. Of those 24 states in D.C., only 20 of them actually require that the information that's being delivered be medically accurate. And so that's a really sort of disturbing thing, if you think about it, that schools could be delivering sex education information that's not medically accurate. And then on sort of a, if you're looking at the bigger picture, if we're talking about HIV and AIDS, 33 states require that there's specific education around HIV and AIDS. So there again, we're still not at all the states across the country that are requiring young people to even learn about HIV and AIDS.
What do you make of the fact that HIV and AIDS has been elevated over other venereal diseases, other sexually transmitted diseases and infections?
I think it's interesting. I think that's something that came out of, a lot of legislation that was coming up in the 80s. I think it's stuck as a piece that is important, but also I think that the way we talk about HIV and AIDS today could also be a contributing factor to why young people are not using condoms. So I know when I was growing up and I was, getting very little sex ed that I got in school, HIV and AIDS at that point was often talked about as a deadly disease. And now it's talked about as a disease that you live with and you manage. And so it's, young people don't hear, the emphasis that we heard that this is really important to protect ourselves from it. And while they're hearing about how HIV is passed from one person to another in the many different ways, they're also hearing that there's a lot of different medications that people can use to help live long lives. And so it doesn't seem maybe as scary to them. And as I said earlier, we keep hearing that young people are not thinking a lot about STDs in general. They're thinking about making sure that they're not getting pregnant. And again, they think that, using a hormonal form of birth control is going to provide complete protection for them.
When you talk about teaching sex ed in kindergarten, what kind of information is being imparted at that age?
Sure. So it's a question that a lot of people have when people say, oh my goodness, we're doing sex ed with kindergarten students.
I assume it's different.
It's very different, yeah. Yes. And so what we're talking about at the early ages is helping young people to understand the correct terminology for their body parts, right? So we know a hand is a hand, we know a foot is a foot, but we don't often teach young people the correct names for their genitals. And so there's actually research out there that says it's really good to help reduce sexual violence towards children, and if they know the parts of their bodies and they can say the correct names for them, because then they can testify about, what happened to them. If a young person says, somebody touched my whatever euphemism they learned to call their genitals, that's not something that would be evidence in court. But if they can say, you know, somebody touched my penis or somebody touched my vagina, then that would be something that they could, you know, that could be upheld in court if a person was to sexually assault a child.
So let's just take that kind of information, which is sort of a Richard Scarry thing that kids love to know what things are named kind of a thing. But what, how is it imparted? How do you... is it when they're that young? By the time I had sex ed in fifth grade, which is 150 years ago, you know, it was different. It was super awkward. It was weird. I only remember that it was awkward and weird. I didn't really learn anything. But I'm wondering, in kindergarten, do they understand that they're – is it awkward and weird, or how do they do it?
So we truly believe that parents should be the primary educators of young people around sex education. And what we find often is that parents feel like, yeah, they want to talk about the values and they want to be able to impart the values around their family and their religion and their beliefs around sex education and what the expectations are for their children. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a lot of the mechanics, they want the schools to be able to talk about those things because they feel like maybe like you and I, they didn't get very good sex ed in school, so they don't know what to say to their child. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they don't know what the newest forms of birth control are, you know, just not feeling up to date around the information. And schools will often feel like, well, the parents should be talking to the kids about it. And what ends up happening essentially is the child is left there without the parents or the schools talking to them about it, and they're left without the information. If parents are starting these conversations with their children at really early ages and normalizing talking about body parts with the correct names, then it doesn't become the talk when they are approaching puberty or hit puberty. It becomes a lifelong conversation that they're having, and they're normalizing and opening up those channels of communication with their children. They're building trust. They're normalizing having those conversations so that when young people have questions, they do feel like they can go to their parents, and it's not awkward to come back to them and have those conversations.
What do we know about how early sex as young as 13 and sometimes younger affects emotional development?
Yeah, so I think that there's some research around that. We do know that, you know, obviously all young people go through, you know, heartbreak with the relationships, whether they're sexual relationships or non-sexual relationships. I personally don't know specifically what the research says around this early of an age, and we have to remember that research with young people at this early of an age doesn't happen all that often because it's really hard to get clearance to talk to young people at this young of an age
about this.
Sex. Yeah. Yes. So we don't have a lot of really solid research, just like we don't have solid research just around, you know, lifelong sexuality. You know, we just don't have those things. So, you know, we have to often draw from what we know about the research that we do have, which we, you know, we have the self-reported, and, you know, we make speculations, you know, from that and do what, you know, do what we think is best based on the research we have.
Are parents allowed to opt out their kids in New Jersey?
Yes. New Jersey is an opt-out state.
What kind of rates do you have on that? You know?
That's a great question. So I can tell you anecdotally, when I talk to teachers in schools, I always hear that parents are like, there's maybe one, two parents each year that will opt their kids out. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we have overwhelmingly parent support. And I think that's true across the country. We know from a lot of research that has been done about attitudes around sex ed is that even in extremely conservative parts of the country, parents support developmentally appropriate, medically accurate sex education.
Dan Rice, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Dan Rice is director of training at the New Jersey-based organization ANSWER. They in New Jersey, they teach sex ed, age-appropriate sex ed in K through 12. They have since 1981. We'll continue our conversation about sex education in Ohio and across the country. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Studies show that in some parts of the country, an increasing number of boys as young as 13 are having sex. An absence or lack of adequate sex education is seen as a factor in making that decision riskier. Kevin Lorson is co-program director for the Health and Physical Education Program at Wright State University, where he's a professor. He joins us by phone. Welcome, Kevin Lorson.
Good morning.
Kristen Torres coordinates the Healthy Bodies, Healthy Futures program at Sentero. It's a Central Ohio Behavioral Health and Social Services organization. Sentero, if you're wondering, is a Greek word for compassion. She joins us as well. Welcome, Kristen Torres.
Thank you so much.
What does the state of Ohio require of public school districts when it comes to sex education?
The requirements are a little bit different in terms of they have overall requirements for health education, which those requirements are for graduation. Students are required to complete one half unit, which is a semester of health education, which is a minimum of 60 hours. So that takes care of the high school piece. Schools are required to provide health education in grades K through 12. It's supposed to be part of a well-rounded curriculum. Within that, Ohio then prescribes topics that must be within that curricular piece for health education, and one of those is termed venereal disease education, which is typically where most people would think that sex education fits in. So, and then within that venereal disease education requirement, there are some specific requirements within Ohio Revised Code in terms of what should be and can be taught within that piece.
It's very closely prescribed then.
Yes, it is. Ohio's a little bit different. We're the only state without health education standards, which prescribes what kids would learn. Ohio's a state instead that prescribes what topics we should teach, and venereal disease is one of those topics. And it is an outdated term, and I'm sorry to use that term. Mm-hmm. It's what's in ORC, Ohio Revised Code, so I have to use that terminology to align with that. But yes, there are a number of requirements within that piece of Ohio Revised Code.
There's some other terminology that I wanted to run by you as well. STDs and STIs, sexually transmitted diseases and sexually transmitted infections. What's the going term now?
It goes back and forth, and Actually we're having this discussion on Friday as we work on another project for a model curriculum for health education in Ohio. We go back and forth. It depends on who you look at. So I would say STI has been a little bit more contemporary, but then folks also still go back to STD. So I don't have a definite answer for that one. It depends on who you talk to.
So confusing. Kristen, do words matter?
They really do. STD comes with a lot of baggage. And so to use that terminology can oftentimes be really kind of pejorative, nasty, dirty, shame on you, a lot of values-laden things around it. So changing that terminology does make a difference. And also I is for infection. And we think of infection as curable, and that seems a lot nicer than something that you have forever.
It seems like so much of this is wrapped up in negative connotations, Kevin Lorson. I'm wondering, even as you start teaching about as you're teaching at the college level, are people uncomfortable with it?
I don't know as if comfort is part of it. It's navigating the territory, so to speak, as we've already talked, that there are very specific laws about what to do and what not to do. I think that makes folks a little bit nervous. And our students over time, I think our future teachers, we learn how to deal with controversial topics. Typically in health education, we might deal with sensitive issues, whether it is sex ed, whether it's drugs, alcohol, tobacco, all of those could be sensitive topics. Mm-hmm. So I think we learn over time how to discuss, share, and help students learn about some of those sensitive topics.
What does the state say not to do?
I think
do we have enough time?
Well, we have a list of what to do. Okay. And the state primarily, the Ohio Revised Code shares that we should emphasize abstinence from sexual activity is the only protection that is 100% effective against unwanted pregnancy, sexually transmitted disease, and the sexual transmission of a virus that causes acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. So I read specifically from ORC there. So and much of that work was done in the 90s and early 2000s.
So even the Ohio General Assembly isn't very interested in dealing with these issues.
There are bills that usually come forward in the General Assembly. There are actually, I think, probably four folks would consider to be in this realm right now that typically address this issue. Almost every session of the General Assembly has at least one bill in each, the House and the Senate, trying to modify this part of ORC to talk about comprehensive sex education versus this abstinence-only approach that is currently in law.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sex education today. We, in a recent study, showed that in some parts of the country, an increasing number of boys as young as 13 are having sex. Of course, these are studies that depend on self-reporting, but be that as it may, no one's saying that it isn't true. If you have a thought about what sex education should involve in the state of Ohio, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Maybe you're a parent who opts out of programs like this and sex ed classes like this for your children or child. Give us a call and tell us why, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kristen Torres, a lot of people don't get their sex ed in this classroom, in schools. They get it from their physician. They get it from the local health clinic. They get it from organizations like yours, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Or they get it nowhere.
Nowhere.
Or from pornography. Mm. Because a lot of our adolescents have streaming devices. So if they have questions, oftentimes they'll go to the internet like
they'll
we
Google
do.
Google it, right.
Yeah, exactly. And when you Google things around sex, oftentimes your results are pornographic, unfortunately.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
And what's your sense about the people that you see, the kids that you talk to, about how active they are and how that manifests in terms of risky behavior?
I will tell you that they are hungry for knowledge.
Okay.
And that they are hungry for knowledge from somebody who is a safe adult person who they know is going to be honest with them about information. Students disclose all kinds of things to me and things that would seem shocking to you and shocking to their parents, I'm sure. So things are happening and people are sexually active. They're just not talking about it because we don't do a great job in our culture in general of talking about sex. We're still pretty puritanical when it comes to that. But it's really important for me to make a situation where they feel incredibly comfortable to ask, because as an adult person who has access to resources, I can make a difference for them. And I take that very seriously.
Can you give me an example of how that transpired with any case? Of course, you don't have to name names.
Sure, sure. I had a student come to me after a session, and they typically have about 4 minutes between classes. So that's when these conversations are happening usually. And she asked me about a sex act that a partner had asked her to perform that she felt really uncomfortable with. And she wanted to know why they had asked her to do that or to perform that. So we had a really good conversation about where people get their ideas about sexuality. Again, back to pornography. If I see something in a video, I think that's what quote-unquote girls like or boys like, and I should do those things. And so we talked about her feelings around it, and then we talked about communication with a partner and why that was really important to be able to talk about their body boundaries.
Kevin Larson, what do you wish teachers could teach in Ohio schools about sex?
I would actually take a step back from it merely being sex education. Mm-hmm. For us to only have 60 hours to teach health education, and then really in kindergarten through eighth grade, in middle schools, maybe two-thirds of kids get any health education at all. And if you go back to even K-5, we get almost nothing. And so for me, I would step back, and there are things, and Kristen shared that real quick about communication and decision-making skills. In health education, we would like folks to be able to learn and develop skills that they can use across any topic. Mm. So I would take a step back and say health education in general, for any topic, we should really be learning about decision-making, communication skills, already mentioned too is valid and reliable health resources, some self-management skills, advocacy skills of encouraging myself and others to make healthy choices. So I would take a step back and look at health more as a global piece where we can build these skills so that kids could apply them in a variety of different situations to be healthier, whether that, again, is alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, whether that is sex, whatever it may be, even healthy eating. Those are key skills that we can apply across, and we don't get a chance to teach them because we just don't have the curricular space to do that.
Steve and Bexley, you're on the air with Kevin Lorson from Wright State University and Kristen Torres from Sentero. Can you turn down your radio, Steve? Okay.
Actually, I don't have my radio on.
Okay.
I just had one quick comment to make. Several times you've said that surveys say that boys as young as 13 are having sex. Presumably, if they're having sex, they're having it with somebody. And presumably, a lot of those somebodies are girls. So this isn't just an issue for boys.
No, no one ever said it was. It's just the peg that's recent research that came out. On the other hand, you know, what do we know about who young people as young as 13, if they're having sex, are they necessarily? Do we know that it's probably a 13-year-old girl that they're having it with, Kristen Torres?
Right. We don't know. And I oftentimes in healthy relationship programming talk about equitable relationships and how a balance of power changes when there are big age gaps and age differences. And I have had students disclose very huge age differences in sexual relationships.
What about that, Kevin Lorson? Do we know much about how people get started, how young kids get started so young?
Outside of the youth risk behavior surveys, which I think is kind of where some of this data is coming from,
yeah.
That's probably the only place where we would find much of that information.
Okay. But Steve and Bexley, we're not assuming that this isn't a girl thing, too. It's just spurred the conversation is all. And thanks for your call. Brian in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hey, I just wanted to ask a question about pornography, and your guest lightly touched on it. I've seen a number of TED Talks and read a number of research papers on the alarming rates of access and exposure of pornography to teenage boys, and I was just curious, is that something that is playing a role? I grew up in the 80s, and you really had to work to find a dirty magazine, or at least where I grew up, but
yeah.
Now, like you mentioned, you just open your smartphone, and I was just curious if that had some kind of role in exposure to young boys. And I'll take my comments off the phone. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Kristen Torres?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, especially in middle school, some of the questions that I get, there is no way from personal experience that they could have knowledge of the things that they're asking about. And I know for sure that they're seeing them in pornography. And I know for sure because
films, and
exactly,
they can get everything online now.
Yes, they can. And they're smarter with their devices than we are. So as he talked about that hunt for the dirty magazine or video, absolutely, it's much easier now. And that does impact the information that they're taking in.
Yeah. Kevin Lorson, is that, you know, something that, for instance, where you get information from, that's a good conversation to have as well, right?
Yeah, and that was back to one of the standards that we had talked about that might be a key learning outcome is accessing valid and reliable health information. And so if they are accessing, who is that trusted, valid resource that they can go to? Is that a parent? Is that a teacher? To clarify what confusions might be out there or misunderstandings. And I would agree with Kristen that we play a role in that.
What about the classes? Should they be co-ed or should they be separated by gender or gender identification?
For me, that's a local school decision mm-hmm. for the most part. And you know, I think folks would find benefits to go either route. And so the recommendation would be for local control to decide what might be best for them. And that may change even developmentally over time.
Yeah.
I could see benefits to co-education, especially when we're learning about healthy relationships. So, and it that's all. I'll leave it the rest to Kristen.
Kristen Torres?
I am a big proponent of co-ed education. I never want my young people to think that there's anything magical that I'm telling
the other side
they can't know. And also, I think it breaks down a lot of stereotypes. We can get into conversations about this double standard that still exists in our culture. You know, when a biomale student talks about having a, what they call a high body count, which means a high number of partners, he can be praised by his peers. Whereas if I have a high number of partners because I am a biofemale person, then I may be slut-shamed by my peers. So I think it starts a lot of those good conversations. But I'll let you know, I often will let schools know that I am available to do single-sex groups if they feel like that is necessary for them, in addition to the programming that we're already doing.
You go into schools?
Yes. I have been teaching in schools for a decade. And so we educate about 7,000 learners per year, and that includes parents as well.
That's interesting. Parents as well. What kind of interest do they have? Is it they're coming to you to teach their own kids how to talk about it?
So oftentimes I get asked, can you just come to my house so you can so which I say, no thanks.
No
private sessions today. I'll tell you, when I have done programming that talks about the birds and the bees and safe sex, I don't get any parents to come. Oh. But when I have did this presentation most recently about consent, I had lots of parents come. And especially when you're talking about consent in terms of like hashtag Me Too movements, uh-huh, and sexual assault, they're very concerned about protecting their young people. But I think talking openly about it makes people uncomfortable.
You know, I'm interested in what both of you have to say about this. I think when you say they're very concerned about protecting their young people, they tend to be more concerned about protecting their daughters. And I'm wondering if there's enough attention to protecting boys as well. Kevin Larson?
I think for any parent, I think the priority is on protecting your child, male or female. I think, you know, histories and stereotypes might make us be a little bit more protective of our daughters, but I think we might, I don't know. I'm only a parent of two daughters, so I'm super protective and want them to live healthy and happy lives. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a personal story on the side of that. I will share that. To back up Kristen, the parent education piece is an important piece of this. I think as parents, no one really gave us a book on how to help teach our kids how to live healthy. We learned how to be healthy ourselves, but we really didn't learn how to teach someone else to be healthy, especially our kids. And so that plays a key role in this also, to be able to open those conversations and those learning sessions, whether it is sex, alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. All of those are we didn't get a playbook for that as parents. So it is helpful for parent education from the school system.
We are talking about sex education. If you have a question or comment, if you have thoughts about whether it should be abstinence-only education, whether there should be no sex education in the schools, whether parents should be able to opt out, or what you'd like to see when it comes to sex education, and things as everything from sexually transmitted infections or diseases, HIV, AIDS, to the issues of consent, what's appropriate, how to think about your body and how to think about what you do in a healthy way. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about sex education today. According to the 2013 Ohio Youth Risk Behavior Survey, nearly 3 in 10 high school students reported being sexually active. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer youth in Ohio are additionally marginalized, which increases their risk for sexually transmitted disease and infection. But Ohio school districts are left to establish their own health education curriculum that is supposed to include a chapter about preventing sexually transmitted infection and diseases and HIV and AIDS transmission. Still with us by phone, professor and co-program director for the Health and Physical Education Program at Wright State University, Kevin Larson. Also With us here in the studio, Program Director of the Healthy Bodies, Healthy Futures Program at Sentero, Kristen Torres. Questions or comments? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to ask you, Kristen, about that LGBTQ piece of all of this and how and whether there's any focus on that in your program or what your thoughts are about that.
I think it's really important to good health outcomes that young people can see their relationships reflected in the curriculum that's given. And I think that's part of the problem. When I don't see, you know, people talk about traditional heterosexual marriage between a man and woman and waiting until marriage, then I'm left out of the conversation as right. a queer person. And also, you know, for sharing values around sexuality, maybe I have a teacher who doesn't believe that it's okay for me to be gay. And so that adds an extra layer. So if I feel shame, I oftentimes will do, you know, riskier things because I feel like it's not that important for me. So we do absolutely talk about queer relationships. We also talk about how to communicate with your partners, no matter the variety of your partner. We as well talk about the differences between sexual orientation, gender, and biological sex as a way to learn the definitions to these words and what they actually mean, because I find that people don't really understand the differences. Mm-hmm. So it's important that they and their teachers do.
And Kevin Lorson, is there a piece in your work where you're telling your students, your future teachers, that some kids are going to have access to more regular health care than others, that there's going to be different kinds of questions, more questions, because we know that in different categories, different demographics, they have babies at a younger age, they get more sexually transmitted diseases, that kind of a thing.
Yes, and it's part of our program where we learn how public health and community health interacts with your school. We ask our folks to, even if they're designing a lesson, how does that connect back to local data? So is that school-level data or community-level data? And part of that might be access to care, whether that's preventative care or care. So yes, that is part of making curriculum and the lessons that we would provide meaningful and relevant and really speak to your students and their needs.
Benjamin in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Benjamin. Hello, Benjamin.
Yep. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, I can hear you now. Yep.
How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
I wanted to leave a comment for some of the guests and kind of give my input, because I grew up in Indiana where it's abstinence only, and I think it's really important, especially and from my perspective for young men, there's a lot of pressure not to be bad or to be successful and fulfilling in their sexual relationships moving forward, So that led me and my own personal journey and other guys that I knew growing up. We went to the internet to educate ourselves because abstinence only doesn't talk about a lot of the topics of communicating with your partner or things that can be done or should be done that are proper in the bedroom outside the scope of pornographic material. And we knew that that was not normal, but we also didn't know where to go for what was normal. And that discussion just wasn't an open avenue for us. And I think it's really important for students to get that.
What was the abstinence-only education like for you in Indiana when you were growing up? What can you give us an example of what happened?
So
the
health class.
Yeah.
And we were also given information on anatomical parts. And then beyond that, we were told that the only form of birth control or STD, STI protection that is 100% effective is not to have sex. And then beyond that, teachers were very explicit about the fact that they could not discuss anything more. It was a chapter that was glossed over so quickly, almost out of fear of opening a discussion that might lead to talking about other avenues.
Kevin Lorson, a kid raises his hand in a class like that and asks a question and a teacher can't answer it. What does that say about the state of education?
Well, and I think I would not use the word can't. They might not feel
permitted
to. Yes, they might not feel permitted. They might be perfectly knowledgeable and ready to go, and it might be something that's not an appropriate discussion to have right then and there in the class with everybody else. And there are different techniques to have that conversation in a little bit more of a private manner that protects the dignity of everybody involved. So I think that's helpful in that way, that there are ways that we can address things. I was going to go back to the piece about absence only and comprehensive sex ed. In both cases, we've been so fact-driven that we really haven't taught about decision-making and communication skills. We've left that out of the piece. And the skills might actually transfer to either side of this. If there is a debate between comprehensive and absence only, both of those approaches should be able to be taught in a skills-based approach. And so I would agree that a fact-based approach just doesn't work for much of anybody.
It's not enough. Kristen Torres?
Just I have so many thoughts. Just listening to the conversations. Abstinence is one piece of a larger pie. So I think that we're being sold a bill of goods that isn't correct when we talk about abstinence only or the new buzzword sexual risk avoidance programming. And so a lot of that programming also teaches really unhealthy stereotypes. If we go back to the Ohio Revised Code, they talk about having babies outside of wedlock and how that's damaging to society and damaging to people, which again, really unhealthy stereotypes that lead to really poor health outcomes. So that is definitely problematic, but we want people to learn from good and valuable sources. And if folks don't think that these programming is happening in their schools, it is, and even public schools. And so I often go into classes after educators have been there and I teach medically based science information, and students will go, "Oh, well, that's not what we learned a few weeks ago." And I go, "Oh, so I'm going to teach you how to be a critical thinker, and I'm going to teach you how to evaluate information, even evaluate the things that I'm telling you, because there are no secrets. This is no shim sham show here." So that's important as well.
Benjamin, thank you so much for your call. Julie in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Julie.
Hi, I have a question. We have a 15-year-old boy, and I would like to talk to him about pornography and how the women there are not realistic, I guess, and that's not a real relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some books or articles that would speak to somebody who's 15, 16, 17? I found lots of references for kids around the 13-year-old age, but I want something for a little bit more sophisticated beauty audience.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Julie. Thank you. Kristen Torres?
I think using those younger resources is not a bad place to start. And especially amaze.org has really great videos and information for that middle school set. But to start there, because, you know, I think even older kids, we assume that they are no more and are more sophisticated. And the language that you use definitely is a little different. But I think talking about navigating what they're seeing and understanding that it isn't realistic is definitely great. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking about definitely a lot of articles that I've read for parents. But please know that Planned Parenthood is an incredibly good resource. They have lots of videos, articles, books for parents. There's an entire parent center.
Even about pornography.
Okay. A little bit of everything. And teaching how to have those conversations and how to navigate what they're seeing. So Planned Parenthood is always an awesome organization.
Let's see. We've got a couple calls. I want to get to everything. But Susan in Chicago, you're on the air. Welcome, Susan.
Hi. I have a couple of quick questions. One is, I'd like to be specific about what exactly is unhealthy about teaching that sex outside of marriage is a bad idea. And secondly, I think it's questionable that Planned Parenthood is treated as the expert who is dispassionate. It's like giving gun safety rules teaching to the NRA only because they're the experts. I think Planned Parenthood has a vested interest. But I would like to know what exactly is unhealthy about teaching the sex outside of marriage.
And just to clear, I think Kristen Torres was saying that is an option. It's not the only
one
she mentioned. It's just one of many options. But I'm not sure anybody said anything about it's being unhealthy to wait till marriage. Maybe Kevin Lorson, can you address that? I don't think either of you said that, but maybe I missed something.
That unhealthy idea. And there's been a lot of negative repercussions on society because of the casual acceptance of sex as, you know, as an activity that people have can do without any kinds of consequences
right.
to society.
Right. Well, obviously, we know that's not the case. But Kevin Lorson?
I will go back to Kristen's comments, actually, that we teach abstinence and comprehensive together, and I think there would always be a priority on abstinence, but I think there are opportunities to help kids to learn to understand their decision-making skills and their valid health resources. And I would agree with that Kristen didn't. There are plenty of resources out there, and that is actually one of our main learning outcomes is accessing that valid health resource, which is usually our .gov, the CDC, and some other folks have additional resources out there that could be helpful to both parents and kids out there.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for your call. Emily in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on, like, I'm a mother of two. They're not in school yet, but I definitely think that sex education should start at kindergarten, learning about your body. And so that everyone is on the same page, I think when kids are getting different information and different, like, specific to your family type of information, mm-hmm. then there can be some confusion amongst peers. And I was wondering if in that type of curriculum, do they also teach body anonymity? So, because one thing I think happens with young children and how young children can get in those situations, he had mentioned, like, they don't know, like, he touched my vagina.
Right, yeah. The guest we had on at the beginning of the hour, Dan Rice from the New Jersey-based organization Answer, did say that they specifically teach about, you know, the body parts, what they're called, where they're located, and just particularly for that reason, so that they can identify when they've been assaulted, what happened.
Do they teach that, like, your body is your own? Because so often little kids are like, you should hug Nana because Nana loves
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And I think that can have negative effects when they're older, where... Yeah. Well, my boyfriend says he loves me, so I should let him touch me this way,
yeah,
even though she doesn't want that or he doesn't want that.
Yeah. Kristen Torres?
I completely agree. That is one of the conversations that I have with parents around the consent topics and body boundaries. Young people should be learning about, you know, that sort of the old school good touch, bad touch. But that's really important. I mean, when 1 in 5 of our girls and 1 in 20 of our boys is being sexually assaulted or raped, clearly we have an issue around that kind of conversation. I don't teach that young of an age, although I do think it's incredibly important to start as young as possible. It's hard enough for me to get traction for middle schoolers and high schoolers. So that's my fight.
Emily, thank you. And real quick, John, I'm going to squeeze you in, but we're running out of time. Hi, John in Columbus.
Hey, and a great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to mention my extension. I grew up in the 70s. I was a kid. And I just remember the one sex education film of a guy close up his face saying it burned when he peed. And they never told us why. They just said he had sex in it, and that was traumatizing. I can still remember that guy's face.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's just like those old Mr. Bungle, you know, government videos of, like, you know, don't be a Mr. Bungle.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'm sure you've come a long way. I appreciate the show.
Okay, John, thank you. Yeah, mine was the, as Kristen Torres and I were talking off here, the floating uterus and the flying sperm. That's what I learned about. I didn't know where anything came from or where it went. Kevin Lorson, just in closing, I mean, we're just about out of time, but how do we progress on this score when the state dictates?
Well, I think as we continue to move forward, we've realized the importance of health, and schools will play a role in healthy kids moving forward. And so as we move forward in teaching kids about their health, I think, like Kristen said, there's fewer opportunities to teach about being healthy in K-5, and it's got to be a K-12 approach that we start to take, and there are many different aspects and avenues that we can go to help kids be healthy. So, but there is lots of work to do with the state being in control, we don't really even know what kids are supposed to learn in health ed. And there's limited offerings. So we have to move forward on that first,
and,
I think.
Kristen Torres, just about 20 seconds.
Yeah, so that's all real. And I will tell you, there's good and bad from it in that, you know, I'm able to provide my programming in a really free way, but so are also the sexual risk avoidance folks. But one more thing to the friend in Chicago that called in, just speaking of like waiting until marriage, when more than 50% of American marriages end in divorce, I don't understand why this is our gold standard. So I think we really need to talk to young people about how to have healthy adult relationships and all the components that come along with that.
That's Kristen Torres. She is program coordinator of Healthy Bodies, Healthy Futures at Sentero. We'll have a link to that organization's website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, Kevin Lorson, co-program director for the Health and Physical Education Program at Wright State University. Thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kristen Torres, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.